From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's start with an interview that seemed to be kind of an aha moment for a lot of listeners.
And for us too, I think I should say. Goes back to 1999, when a social psychologist at Cornell named David Dunning had an idea. He wanted to do some research to explain something. In fact, he's letting the actor John Cleese explain the concept that Dunning's research focused on. Let's listen.
I think the problem with people like this is that they are so stupid that they have no idea how stupid they are. You see, if you're very, very stupid, how can you possibly realize that you're very, very stupid? You'd have to be relatively intelligent to realize how stupid you are. There's a wonderful bit of research by a guy called David Dunning at Cornell, who's a friend of mine, I'm proud to say, who's pointed out that in order to know how good you are at something requires exactly the same skills as it does to be good at that thing in the first place, which means, and this is terribly funny, that if you're absolutely no good at something at all, then you lack exactly the skills that you need to know that you're absolutely no good at it.
Well, you might know it as the American Idol effect. Someone who is incompetent has no clue that they're incompetent. Through Dunning's research, that term is now better known as the Dunning-Kruger effect. And Dunning says the next president often shows classic signs of the Dunning-Kruger effect, convinced he's an expert about things he knows very little about.
So in this clip, you'll hear David Dunning tell us what we can do to have more productive discussions with others who might be in the throes of the Dunning-Kruger effect. But first, we couldn't resist. Evan asked Professor Dunning to tell us how he was inspired to do this research in the first place. It all goes back to a bank robber named MacArthur Wheeler.
Well, the story of MacArthur Wheeler, in short, there's a longer story, but the short story is this is a person who decided to make a career of robbing Pittsburgh banks. And had heard that, well, the day that he was finally caught, he robbed two banks without any attempt at disguise whatsoever. And surveillance tapes of him were shown on the Crime Stoppers segment of the evening news that evening. And he was arrested by the time of the 11 o'clock edition of the news. And he was incredulous that he had been caught. But then the police showed him the surveillance tapes. And he started to mutter, "But I wore the juice. I wore the juice." Apparently, MacArthur Wheeler was under the impression that if you smear your face with lemon juice, it renders it invisible or indistinct to any sort of video camera. So he had this theory about how he could easily rob banks. It was a theory that lasted maybe an afternoon. And, well, the rest gets retold again and again in many an interview.
Now, I have talked to people about this story, and their reaction is there must be something else that we don't know. There's no way he could think that if you rub lemon juice on your face, it renders it unable to be photographed. That is so ridiculous. But from what you understand, this is not apocryphal. This really happened.
Oh, this really happened. And you can also sit back and think there are other probable MacArthur Wheelers we have in our lives who believe things we can't believe that they believe. That's okay. We believe things that they can't believe that we believe. In his case, he did test his theory. He did smear his face once with lemon juice, took a Polaroid of his face, but he misaimed the camera. So all he got was wall instead of face. And so
that was all the evidence he needed, right?
Well, you know, I give him credit for doing the experiment. That's an important part of life. I don't give him credit for being able to take an accurate selfie, but he did at least test the idea.
And so let me close with this then, David. Another comment on Twitter is this. Bill Maher said, "A problem with America is that we're 37th in math, but number one in confidence in our math skills." And that would be Dunning-Kruger effect. I understand your point that we should look within. This isn't just about tarring other people, but what are some final thoughts you have for people who may encounter this in the wild and may think, this is a classic example of Dunning-Kruger that I'm facing, and I don't want to rupture this relationship, but I want this person to confront it. Walk me through more of the toolkit.
Well, it depends whether or not the person is you or the other person.
Right.
Another person, what I would do is ask them, as you've mentioned before, to go ahead and explain their position and see if they have an explanation for their opinion, or do they end suddenly realizing they don't understand things as well as they thought. That is the Socratic method. There is a polite way of doing that with some practice. for example. And there's a polite way to do that with yourself. Okay, this is what I believe. What's my evidence for this? Do I really, really believe this? And that means asking whether or not you might be wrong. That might mean doing an exercise where you assume you're wrong. Now, what must be true of the world? And this is the important thing, that all of the issues of the Dunning-Kruger effect fade as people become more knowledgeable and as they become more expert. So what I would suggest is never let learning lay fallow. That is, learn more about the world. You know, you do want to verify what you're learning about the world, but to the extent that you become more expert, the problems of lack of expertise will fade away.
There's been a lot of talk about fake news recently, so much talk that it has obscured what fake news is. Here's what it's not. Fake news is not news that might contradict some of your previously held beliefs or just news you don't like. But we heard the president-elect saying that CNN is fake news, which is almost certainly an intentional misrepresentation of what that term means.
We welcome Michael Oreskes, NPR's editorial director, along with Neil Shapiro, the former president of NBC News and now the president of WNET in New York. They discussed why they believe public media has earned a position of trust.
You'll hear them talking about the current news landscape, and we'll start with Oreskes explaining how NPR has been able to cover national stories in both the big cities and the small towns and the rural areas.
We're everywhere in the country. You know, we're in Rochester, we're in Marfa, Texas, we're in Minneapolis, we're all over the country, and it really makes a big difference in terms of how we think about news and how we think about what matters. Doesn't mean every day we make exactly the choice any particular listener would make, but it's really very much a part of our metabolism to be thinking about community, the word that you both used there. And I think that's a key part of what makes public media so valuable right now.
I want to ask Neil Shapiro to sort of add his thoughts to what our CEO, Norm Silverstein, was saying about how things might have changed from some of that mentality of be first to be right. And if you do see, given your background, Neil, in various places, do you see a difference between the mentalities on the commercial side and the public side?
Yeah, I still think that the commercial side is, you know, still measure themselves by eyeballs. That's how they get measured. And I think public media tends to measure ourselves by hearts and souls. And, you know, can we care more about thoughts than necessarily what's going to drive a rating? And that's why you see there, you know, if you watch, so there's a story about the three biggest topics ignored by the evening news were poverty, the environment, and I think violence. Three big topics which, you know, which we talk about all the time, or education. Three things we talk about all the time that didn't make its way past the horse race stories on evening news. The other thing I think is very important, and I think the thing that separates public media, is context. That I think we embrace complexity. We need to keep doing a better job of that. But to remind people, you know why a little knowledge is a dangerous thing? Because then you don't realize how complex every issue is. And if you go at every issue with respect, and every person you're interviewing with respect, and try to get both sides of the story, I think you let voters truly, and viewers truly get a sense about how complex these issues are and help them to make informed decisions, whoever they choose to vote for.
One thing I find heartening right now is that Neil's absolutely right, that focusing on loyalty and hearts and minds and focusing on the ideas is what makes us different from those who are focusing on the ratings. But one of the heartening things in the last year has been that by doing it the way we do it, and I think this is true in both public television and public radio, our ratings have gone up. So right. We're clearly creating something that's mattering to more and more people.
We'll turn now to the story of a poet who learned that the state of Texas was using two of her poems for its 7th and 8th grade standardized tests. Here's the problem. Sarah Holbrook took a look at the tests and she couldn't even answer the questions about her own poems. And if she didn't know the answers, she wondered how an 11-year-old student could possibly know.
Well, Holbrook wrote an article for the Huffington Post that went viral. She joined us to describe her frustration with how standardized tests are created and the pressure that results for both students and teachers.
The thing about the test is they are written in a manner that there's more than one right answer. And a lot of them, the questions go to the writer's intent. And my contention is if you don't ask the poet, you have no idea what their intent was, right? You can ask a kid to read a passage and the house in the passage is red, and then you say, what color was the house? That's a fair thing. But why did the author make the house red? It's not a fair question. It is a fair question for discussion and could lead to a wonderful classroom discussion. But as far as a right or wrong answer, I just don't think that's valid.
When it comes to, for example, the stanza break, I found that really interesting because you say that you're sort of a performance poet, that you like to read your work aloud, and sometimes that feels like a natural place to put a break in, and yet students were being asked to sort of discern a hidden meaning that might not have been there?
Yes, exactly. And I think poets in general, we punctuate our poem according to how we want it read. So I want the reader to pause there. And I put a stanza break in. So the same reason in the other poem, there is a word in all caps, and I put it in all caps. Kind of this, the word is today, so that when you read it, it sort of screams from the page, the same way you might do that in a Facebook post or an email. You put it in all caps. You want that word to scream out. That was not one of the choices.
Question 33. What is the most likely reason that the poet uses capitalization in line number 6? Here are the choices for the students. To highlight a problem the speaker experiences, to stress the speaker's expectations for tomorrow, to indicate that the speaker's condition happens unexpectedly, or to show the speaker's excitement about an upcoming event. And Sarah, in her piece for the Huffington Post, wrote the following, quote, well, it could be A, all caps is a way to highlight a fact, right? I guess I wanted to stress the fact that the feelings belong to today, but maybe the answer is B. Let's see, today is not tomorrow, could be that, but climbing into the test maker's mind, I'm guessing they want answer C, to indicate that the speaker's condition happens unexpectedly. But here's the thing. I remember adding the all caps during revision. Was it to highlight the fact that it arrived today, or was it to indicate that it happened unexpectedly? Not sure. Move on. Lots to cover. End quote.
Right.
So that's amazing, Sarah. I mean, you really are looking at that question, and you're guessing what you think the test maker wants, but there's not a clear answer, and you're the one who wrote the poem.
Right. And I don't know what else to say about it, except that someone is sitting behind a computer screen making up these questions. And then the kids' lives depend on it, you know, whether or not they're going to be promoted. My own daughter is a teacher in Virginia. 40% of her evaluation is based on how her fourth graders do on these guessing games. And I consider them guessing games.
Now let's talk about transportation. There are plenty of people who want to see light rail come to Rochester. We sat down with Bill Carpenter, the CEO of the Regional Transit Service. In this clip, you'll hear him explain why light rail probably isn't coming to Rochester anytime soon and how transportation relates to poverty.
Light rail, extremely expensive, millions of dollars per mile to build. And I'll say to people, so where would you like it built? And some people say, well, from downtown to Charlotte. Okay, well, that's about $100 million. I don't have $100 million. Well, from downtown to the University of Rochester. Okay, well, why not RIT? Okay, out to RIT. Well, why not to the East End, not just downtown? And pretty soon you have a $500 million project. And we're talking about $600 million for this area to completely re-energize our economy under photonics. Do I want to say, well, give me a $500 million light rail system? I just think as far as community priorities go,
not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. Until someone says, here's $500 million or $1 billion specific for public transportation, then I would look at them and say, with the poverty we have, shouldn't we be creating jobs?
I know you heard Pete Nabosny on the program and probably read some of his work for Reconnect Rochester. He's a researcher with the Center for Governmental Research, and he wrote a 6-part series about the intersection of poverty and transportation. And one of his comments that I wanted to get your take on, Bill, is something that, you know, it may not be directly under your influence, but I want to see if you agree with the premise that Pete is laying out here. Because he talked about how important the transit center is for Rochester, how many people go through there, just as you said. And if poverty is going to be alleviated and we're going to be serving people particularly who don't have cars, who rely on RTS, the development has to sort of follow them where they go on bus routes and particularly to the transit center. Let's listen to what Pete had to say about that.
We shouldn't be building parking garages next to our most transit accessible place in the city. And the truth is that that transit center is completely surrounded by surface lots, which is kind of crazy, but also garages. And I understand why, and there's dynamics that go into recruiting, you know, employers downtown and new development and things like that, and this desire for parking. But I think we need to be kind of strategic about how we're organizing our area around the transit center and recognizing that that's the most transit accessible place that we have. And if people could hop off the bus and walk a half a block to work, then that becomes a much more viable opportunity for a lot of people in terms of taking the bus.
All right, Bill, do you agree with that?
I would love to see more employment downtown, absolutely. As long as you've got development being incented for private developers, they're going to go where it maximizes their profit. I co-chair one of the work groups for the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council. And part of my work there has been to raise the visibility of all the infrastructure. Is there good water sewers there, water systems there, road infrastructure, and public transportation infrastructure where development is being done? And I think the Conserve opportunity in Victor, and where they wanted to put 1,000 people in Victor, a parking for 1,000 people. And quietly, we did reach out to some of the key stakeholders there and said, there's not going to be good public transportation at that location. We don't serve it now. We don't have money to serve it in the future. And that quietly went away. Those are the kinds of conversations that Pete mentioned need to be had. And when you get a call center with 1,000 people or 2,000 people, why can't it be at Medley Center where we have, it's empty space and we have good systems now? Those are questions we ask, but it's a private developers, and until they can maximize their opportunity, it really needs to become a community-wide conversation. Public transportation is going to serve where those destinations are, and opportunities like this to educate, put that on the checklist. Is this the best location? Can we make it work somewhere else? And I do think we're seeing businesses responding to that. I said at the opening the huge changes that have taken place with phones, Facebook, and how information is shared. And I said transportation will go through that same metamorphosis. I think 10 years from now, the number of people walking and biking and wanting to live in an urban area, it will become important if you want to attract people to have that kind of infrastructure.
We'll close the week with a clip from our freewheeling discussion about how music can become a form of political speech. From classical music in Eastern Europe to NWA to Woody Guthrie, our panel covered a wide range.
In this clip, we focus on Dmitri Shostakovich, a Russian composer who had gotten himself into some trouble in the mid-1930s. Shostakovich composed his Fifth Symphony, hoping to convince Stalin it was a work that paid tribute to the Soviet greatness and regime, while signaling to the proletariat that he was actually with them. You'll hear some of that music along with Lisa Jakelski, Associate Professor of Musicology at the Eastman School of Music, and our colleague Mona Segetola-Slami from Classical 91.5.
What's interesting about Shostakovich in the 1930s is that the Fifth Symphony really is a piece that works on multiple levels. And part of the reason why it can do that is because it's a piece of symphonic music. There's not a text that's attached to it. It's a piece of instrumental music. We don't have singers, for example, who are giving us a text that conveys a clear message. And so we have like this piece of music that in many respects sort of follows a developing template of what, say, a symphony in the Soviet Union should be, coming from this sort of like tumultuous beginning to a triumphant kind of ending. And yet at the same time, because of the various things that are happening in it, particularly like this really wrenching slow movement, which has evocations of Mahler as well as, say, like the Russian Orthodox funeral service, there's also a way in which like the piece also works against that very kind of official interpretation. I think this is one of the things that makes Shostakovich such a wonderful person to think about.
Do we suffer from some motivated reasoning when we think about the Fifth, for example, from Shostakovich, thinking that, no, he was signaling to the solidarity with the suffering people? That's what that was really about.
You know, I think if we try to come up with figuring out absolutely what this 100% absolutely is about, I think we almost paint ourselves into a corner, because I think one of the things that's really sort of most interesting about it is how it can sort of mean so many different things to so many different people.
Mona, do you think there's some motivated reasoning here as we listen to this right now? And bring it up for a second here, John. So, Mona, maybe motivated reasoning says to me, you know what I hear? I hear him showing sarcastically what he thinks Stalin wants to hear, knowing that Stalin isn't going to be clever enough to realize that what he's actually saying to the people is, we understand the pain that you've been through.
Well, and it is sometimes strange to me to realize that the composers that we always mention sarcasm with are Shostakovich and Prokofiev, the two best-known Soviet composers. Is it something about their output? Prokofiev also has a piece called Sarcasms. There's a wryness, a wit, a questioned, again, that heroic narrative of the symphony of here we go, which had already been challenged by Tchaikovsky with his Pathétique. That was about personal suffering rather than political, that the last movement of his Sixth Symphony, the heroic end is the third movement, and then there's the sad bit after it, which breaks the mold. You know, that's like having a song end wrongly, right? You know, so we already have this model for questioning. And I don't think it takes a lot to see that. I don't think we're only reading it into it. And I'm looking forward to wrestling with that as I learn to play it with the RPOs playing it, but also the orchestra I play in, the Robert Szlezian College Community Orchestra. And as a player, I think, and maybe Terry can speak to this, is that you get into the point of playing it that you enjoy the heroism, even if you're questioning the politics of the moment. It's a satisfying feeling, that narration of, you know, something to bold, you know, Beethoven shaking your fist at God, symphonic glory.
That does it for Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend.